Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host a Courthouse Steps oral argument on Ames, the Ohio Department of Youth Services, featuring Nicholas Berry. Nick has been Senior Litigation Counsel at American First Legal since 2022. During that time, he has filed numerous lawsuits challenging lawless actions by governments and businesses. Previously, he litigated catastrophic malpractice cases. Before that, he litigated cases as an Assistant Attorney General for the Tennessee Attorney General's Office. A graduate of Vanderbilt Law School, he began his career clerking for Judge William Bertelsmann in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Kentucky. Our moderator today is William Trackman. Will is a general counsel from Mountain States Legal Foundation. Previously, he was appointed to serve in the Department of Education as Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Office for Civil Rights. He's also chair of the Colorado Federal Society, the vice chair of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights' Colorado Advisory Board, and adjunct professor at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, thank you both for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Thanks so much, Marco. Great to be here. Happy to have our honored guest, Nick Berry, with us today to talk about the case of Ames, the Ohio Department of Youth Services. Interesting oral argument this morning, a little bit less than an hour, which by this court standards in equal protection and race cases, a little bit short, but we're excited to have a pretty sizable crowd here. As Marco mentioned, we do have a Q&A box. For those of you who want to chime in, please do so early so that we know about how many questions we're going to go. We're going to go somewhere between probably 30 and 50 minutes, depending on the questions, and talk through, in Courthouse Steps nature, the oral argument that occurred this morning in Ames. Nick, great to have you here. Let's start at the broadest level possible. Tell me about the background of the case in Ames and then how we got to the court's argument this morning.
Sure. Thanks, Will. So for those of you who litigate for a living in the trial courts, I'll start there. We had a complaint and a first amended complaint that were filed in the case. And I'll just go through the claims quickly because I think they're relevant for where we ended up. But there was a gender and sexual orientation discrimination claim under Title VII, a hostile work environment claim under Title VII, a retaliation claim under Title VII. Then we had an age discrimination claim under the ADEA. And then a 14th Amendment due process rights violation under Section 1983, and then age discrimination, gender discrimination, and hostile work environment claims under the Ohio Human Rights Act that they have in Ohio. Now, early in the case, under a judgment on the pleadings, which you don't always see, but it was successful here in barring counts 4, 6, 7, 8, which were age discrimination under the ADEA, and then all of the state law claims. And then they were granted a dismissal for claims 2, 3, and 5 for failure to plead facts. So the only claim that ended up remaining was the gender and sexual orientation discrimination claim. So we had a narrow claim in front of the court as it moved forward, went through discovery and made it to summary judgment. At summary judgment, both claims were dismissed. And the court clearly articulated that the plaintiff failed to satisfy the background circumstances requirement that's in the Sixth Circuit. So Ohio argued that they failed to show that. The court agreed with them. They appealed it up to the Sixth Circuit. The Sixth Circuit ultimately had a prior opinion from a prior panel that said the Sixth Circuit was adopting the background circumstances test. In a per curiam opinion that's fairly short, the Sixth Circuit agreed with Ohio that they failed to meet the background circumstances. Judge Kethledge wrote a concurrence, which I think are always helpful, effectively saying, yes, This is the requirement because we're bound by precedent and prior panel decisions, but this does create some problems and probably isn't correct, but this is what we're bound to do. And then it got taken up by the Supreme Court, and then we had the argument today on, I think, a fairly narrow question. Overall, the question presented by Ames was whether, in addition to pleading the other elements of Title VII, a majority group plaintiff must show, quote, background circumstances to support the suspicion that the defendant is the unusual employer who discriminates against the majority. So that's what we were up at SCOTUS today on. That's what was up at SCOTUS today on.
Yeah, let's take a step back. Obviously, we've got a statute here, Title VII, that says employers, not just government employers, but private employers, can't discriminate based on protected classes. So generally we have at-will employment throughout the country, at least under federal law. And there are ways to fire employees for lots of different reasons. But some reasons you can't fire employees are for their race, their religion, and here, their sex. I do want to hear your thoughts on the Bostock angle here in a second. But the interesting thing about the sex part of Title VII is that it covers homosexual employees, and that's the rule in Bostock. And then if you do the same logical move that you do in Bostock, which is if you flip the sex, would the employer's behavior be the same? You would do the same analytical move here, I suppose, and say that Title VII protects straight employees as against discrimination based on sexual orientation for them being straight. So background circumstances, that seems to be the phrase of the day. Let's talk about what that means, because background circumstances is just a vague phrase. What is it that an employee has to do, and how do you figure out whether someone's a majoritarian plaintiff, or is it just always obvious?
Right. So background circumstances, basically the cases say that it has to be the unusual employer who discriminates against the majority, and that you have to show certain things that exist, such as prior hiring decisions. They have a list in the, you know, case law of what you can show to meet this test, but it's really not so like the second part of your question after the background circumstances, how do you show who's majority, minority? I don't think there's an answer to that. At least there hasn't been articulated in the case law. We pointed it out, AFL did, in our amicus brief. How do you determine that? Here, it looks like under the facts, two of the principals that were making decisions were gay, I think. So is that the majority? The majority of the hiring decision was made by gay employees, or is it the majority of that company? Is it the majority of the state the company's in? Is it the majority? I mean, how do you determine this? And if that's the case, women are a majority of people. Does that mean that they don't have a minority status under the law? So it's unclear how this is even determined. It seemed to just be presumed in the law that who the majority was and who the minority was. And it was a presumption in the law. And I think the problem with this case is the background circumstances effectively creates a rebuttable presumption that majority candidates, however you define majority, aren't discriminated against. And so they have some additional burden they have to overcome to show that there was discrimination against them. So yeah. I think there's kind of multiple layers there as to the problems that exist with the background circumstances.
It's interesting because if you took the analysis logically, you would say, well, I guess in Washington, D.C., Caucasians have a lower burden for pleading employment discrimination than African-Americans do because they're a smaller percentage of the population, or maybe they're close to equal. But the idea would be that depending on the employer's ambit of who they might hire, or I suppose maybe fire if you're in the workplace, the pleading standards would change up or down depending on who counts as a majoritarian plaintiff. You can already see from our preliminary conversation this is a house of cards, and it's about to fall down pretty rapidly once we get into the courtroom. So Nick, tell me about your initial impressions from the advocate for the employee here, Marlene Ames, who worked for the University of Virginia Supreme Court Clinic.
Yeah, I think I would have preferred to go in the posture that that advocate came into the court on. You know, as you mentioned under Title VII, I think it's always important to go back to the statutory text that we're supposed to be looking at, or that the court is supposed to be looking at here. Nowhere in that statutory text does it talk about majority, minority, or background circumstances, which might shock someone who has never practiced in this area. What it actually says is it shall be an unlawful employment practice for an employer to fail or refuse to hire or to discharge any individual, or otherwise to discriminate against any individual with respect to his compensation terms, et cetera, because of such individual's race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. So the statute is clearly driven around individuals, not around majorities, not around minorities. And yet we have a Supreme Court case right now that just got heard, and it was about whether or not a majority, alleged majority plaintiff had additional burdens to state their prima facie case or to be able to maintain their claim, when the Sixth Circuit said, yes, they do in fact have additional burdens. So I think coming in as that advocate would have been the preferred position, because you had a lot to dig on to be able to go in with that. And I think from the court's perspective, they seem to be in agreement with that position, that this background circumstances thing does in fact create an additional burden, and that it probably is not appropriate that it has this additional burden that's created.
We'll definitely get to some tea leaf reading. In the meantime, though, I want to talk through a little bit more of the oral argument from Zhao Wang with the University of Virginia. He seemed, as you said, to have the wind at his back, running downhill on a scooter, maybe, just seemingly having the moral high ground of saying, look, Title VII means what it says, and there's nothing in there about background circumstances or creating a higher burden on whether it be heterosexual, white, male plaintiffs who are alleging employment discrimination. I thought the Chief Justice Roberts kind of played the part a little bit at the beginning by saying, well, if you've got an employer who's got 60 employees and only 10% of them are Black, and then you have this job opening and nobody gets hired for it, Do the Caucasian employees, the 54 of them, do they have just as much of a claim as the six African Americans who might say, well, you've left this job open, no one's getting it, it's probably because of our race? Isn't it more likely that they're discriminating against the six African Americans than the 54 Caucasians? And Mr. Wang handled that saying, well, you can consider that as a factor at the end of the day about whether discrimination is really at play or some third motivation that has nothing to do with race. But at the front end, he wouldn't say, okay, we're going to heighten the standard for the 54 Caucasian employees there that might want the promotion. That was deft that, you know, that he did that and essentially answered really the one issue that I thought might be a problem going in, which is this intuition that no rational employer would really discriminate against, you know, a huge portion of the population, because any rational employer would want to hire the best. And so discriminating against the majority of people wouldn't make sense. Now, all that said, the advocate for the Ohio Department of Youth Services had an uphill battle. Tell me about your thoughts with regard to his argument.
Yeah, the position from Ohio didn't make a lot of sense to me going in. They seem to be arguing from their briefs, and it came out in oral argument, that the background circumstances test didn't actually create any additional burden for Ames, and that it was just a rearticulation or an articulation with different words of the actual McDonnell Douglas test and Title VII's standards. So there was no higher burden for Ames. It was just the burden, and Ames failed to meet it. The court, I think, rightly pointed out, multiple justices did, in fact, saying, well, but the Sixth Circuit clearly said that but for this higher burden, Ames would have met the standard. And he said, yeah, I mean, we just have to ignore that. And, you know, that's not, they didn't really mean what they said. And Judge Kethledge didn't really mean what he said when he wrote that. So, yeah, I thought that was an uphill battle to go into it. But I thought overall, you know, with that position and having to take that with a fairly hostile court, that was a tough spot to be in.
Yeah, clearly the advocate, and I don't have his name handy, had a good idea going in that he was going to try to get the judgment affirmed and avoid the difficult question. The problem was the difficult question was the QP. It was the question presented, and the justices were not interested in saying, let's talk about something else besides what we granted review on. And I think Justice Gorsuch has become fond of this phrase, radical agreement, which I've heard in a few different oral arguments. And here he immediately seized on the concession from this gentleman that he agreed that every plaintiff ought to be treated equally under the law when it came to their burdens to establish employment discrimination. And really, that for me, at least, that was probably the end of the oral argument, that the result is going to be something like, we've got radical agreement on that point. So before I ask then to see if you've got the same tea leaf reading that I do, let me remind the audience that we've got questions. We already have a couple of questions in the queue. So if you want to drop those questions, please do so. So then from the questions and the tenored oral argument, you know, if you want to venture a thought into what an opinion might look like, or who might write, or what concurrences or dissents we might see.
Yeah, I think there was really broad agreement from the advocates and from the court that having additional standards based on someone's race or sex or religion or national origin or color is problematic. They didn't really get into it, but, you know, we could sit here and think that, you know, if a white person has a higher burden to state a claim, or a black person has a higher burden to state a claim, is that not a denial of equal protection? And if the courts are in the business of interpreting a statute in such a way that it denies equal protection, is the court not violating the Constitution itself in such an analysis? And so, you know, I think that's kind of the background that the court was likely, at least in my view, looking at through the lens of as they analyze this. This was, you know, a sexual orientation claim, sex discrimination claim, which is a whole different, I think, problem. There's no, at least in my mind, clear standard. That's not going to get at least a clear standard of review for that. I know Bostock says that, you know, sexual orientation and transgender status are protected classes now in some way. And, you know, I'm guessing that this is likely going to be, in my view anyway, it seems like it's going to be a 9-0 decision. I can't imagine what a dissent would be here if they have a narrow, and I'm guessing it's going to be a narrow opinion on the question presented. Given Kagan's prior writings, I expect that Justice Kagan will probably get the pen on it. Just to say that, you know, there is one standard, it applies to everybody. There's no special standard based on majority minority status, and we'll get a narrow ruling in that effect. But there was definitely an opportunity here, maybe with a different question presented, or maybe if there was a more aggressive advocate trying to get cert that could have gotten a different question presented, maybe the Ohio Solicitor General could have argued some different arguments that I think would have been broader.
Yeah, and I do want to, in a second, ask you about, you know, what if the Ohio SG had said, actually, Bostock is bad law and you should revisit it, you know, 5 years later. What an interesting different case we might have. I had the same reading as you. You know, a couple of cases we had this case, a couple of terms ago, we had a case called Muldrow, which involved how adverse, how severe the discrimination had to be to raise an employment discrimination claim. So in that case, the plaintiff was not fired. She wasn't demoted. Her pay wasn't cut. She was merely reassigned and transferred to a new work station. And the allegation was out of discrimination. And the court said, yeah, that can count. Title VII means what it says. You don't need to meet some higher level of really, really severe in order to bring the claim. And that was a 9-0 opinion written by Justice Kagan with a couple of concurrences talking about discrimination itself being an injury. And not to toot my own horn, but I saw that coming a mile away in this case. And Mountain States wrote an amicus brief saying, don't go small. Don't just decide this case like you did Muldrow. Go big. Craft a sweeping judicial opinion about the horrors of the use of race in courtrooms around the country, citing some of the work that your firm has done, America First Legal has done. Last year, you folks sent a letter to, I think, Chief Justice Roberts, saying there are three judges in Illinois who are using race as a factor to decide when to grant oral argument to litigants before them. Some folks at the Hamilton Lincoln Law Institute had written a comprehensive analysis of courts that were using race as a factor in designating class counsel for class representatives and class actions. And we said, look, this is happening a lot more. It's not just pleading standards in Title VII or summary judgment standards in Title VII. It's happening a lot, and you ought to go big in order to respond to those sorts of instances. So my hope is that it's not narrow. I mean, I agree with you, it probably will be. My hope is that we get some sweeping opinion from Justice Alito or Justice Thomas or Justice Gorsuch or even the Chief, talking about the ills of race discrimination and how awful this is, and maybe giving us a little bit of an addendum to SFFA. One thing that I thought was interesting, and I'm curious if you have a take on this, it actually felt a little bit discordant with SFFA, because we were talking about these buckets of races. Like, suppose you have 54 Caucasians and 6 African-Americans, and then this happens and then that happens. You know, how do you compare one race against another? And we just had this really watershed case 2 years ago about how race isn't so easily categorized, and the buckets don't really matter for affirmative action purposes. Did that occur to you at all as you were listening to oral argument?
Yeah, I thought it was funny coming from Roberts. I mean, especially given, I mean, one of his, at least in my mind, famous lines is the way to stop discriminating on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. I mean, it's a stupid, simple articulation of the concept, but I think it's powerful in its simplicity, because we now live in a society where DEI and ESG has kind of taken over corporate boardrooms. It has taken over government. It has taken over even some of the courts, where they're granting opportunities based on quote unquote race. But there is a good question on how is that decided? And I did think it was funny that he brought up that question. I was kind of curious to see if we'd get an answer along that way, that, well, how do you know they're 54 right, white Caucasians? How do you, are they self-categorized? Have we looked up pictures and then just determined it? Like, what was the, how did we do that here? But I did enjoy that bit.
Mm-hmm. Now, one part of the argument that we haven't talked about, and I just want to button this up, is that there was this giant rabbit hole about the McDonnell-Douglas test that really didn't have much to do with race at all. But because the parties themselves had so little to talk about, it ended up becoming kind of a dominant sub-theme of the oral argument about whether the McDonnell-Douglas test, which is a burden-shifting test about what the plaintiff has to say, then what the defendant has to say, then back and forth, whether that's a good model. And there's another case that's on the horizon for the court about this. And I think even Justice Gorsuch said, I'm going to ask you some unfair questions about McDonnell Douglas. And Zhao Wang for Ms. Ames said, I'm going to try to give you a fair response. Do you want to talk about this rabbit hole before we move on?
Yeah, sure. Just for those who don't know, the McDonnell Douglas test, basically gave a framework, an analytical framework, by which to think about Title VII that said you have to do a prima facie showing that the person belongs to a racial minority, that person applied was qualified for the job, that despite the qualifications, they were rejected, and that after rejection, the position remained open or was filled by another applicant with similar qualifications from a different minority, I guess. In that case, it was a racial minority, but the idea being someone opposite or different than you. And so you could presume that's the prima facie showing. And then the company can come in, or, the employer comes in and says, no, we had a justifiable reason. For example, that person was a jerk, we didn't like them, or, they got a bad review, or whatever the justifiable reason is. We could think of a million of them. We've all worked with other people, probably been that person ourselves now and again. And then the plaintiff then gets to show pretext, that no, that's a pretextual reason. The real reason was discrimination. And there's different ways they can go about doing that. So McDonnell Douglas kind of laid that out. And yeah, it's up for I guess, reconsideration by the court in another case that's coming up. So they did touch on that quite a bit. I was interested that they touched on it quite a bit. I mean, again, if we go back to the Title VII statute and what it says, it doesn't, McDonnell Douglas test is not in there. I certainly think that the McDonnell Douglas test is kind of an analytical framework by which to think about Title VII, but it's certainly not part of the statute and it's certainly judge made. And there seems to be a tendency right now by the court from going back and looking at some of these older frameworks and saying, well, you know, they're not hard and fast rules that you must apply. They're not the statute. Look at the statute and see what it says and what you have to do to meet that. This was just an analytical way for us to think about, was the statute met, not a mandatory requirement of how to establish liability or how to establish a claim.
Yeah. And by contrast to this case, where this background circumstances doctrine is popping up in various circuits, including my home circuit here in the 10th. I sit in Denver right now. And I think in contrast to the Muldrow case, the McDonnell Douglas test, that's coming straight from the Supreme Court saying this is how you do Title VII. So there you've got lower courts around the country doing it. And unless they revisit it, that's going to be the way it stays. Although I've often heard specifically that it disadvantages plaintiffs claiming religious discrimination because it's hard to disprove the employer, did something for pretextual reasons, but they might have done something for more than one reason, in which case, if it was a motivating factor or a but-for factor, you ought still to have an employment discrimination claim under existing law. Okay, well, we have quite a few questions in the hopper. Reminder for those who have questions to go ahead and drop them in that Q&A box. And then I expect that maybe the questions will draw out additional information about the oral argument itself. The first question is from Dan Dow, asking how, if at all, will this case affect the eventual SCOTUS decision on the Trump administration's executive orders eliminating DEI policies and their argument that DEI violates federal discrimination law. Interesting question. Do you have a take on whether this case will have any impact on the executive orders about DEI?
I don't think it'll have a direct impact on it, but I do think it signals at least several of the court members and where they're at. They recognize that, at least today, they recognize that treating people differently based on their immutable characteristic or otherwise protected, class is improper. And so if we have Trump policies and executive orders saying, look, you can't treat people differently based on their race or sex or gender, then I think the court is probably in agreement with that from the looks of it.
Yeah, I hope there's at least a concurrence saying, this background circumstances test is wrong for the independent reason that it makes no sense. You could have a mixed race plaintiff. You could have a plaintiff from the Middle East or Afghanistan or, one of the countries where in the SFFA argument, they couldn't even figure out the lawyers for Harvard and North Carolina couldn't even figure out how those people would be classified for their racial preference purposes. So the idea that you can just bucket people into races and then apply a different judicial standard to them is itself totally incoherent. And that'll, I think, maybe have some impact on the DEI discussion. Really, the case that is going to bolster the Trump executive orders is going to be SFFA and all the follow-on cases that have talked about the incoherence of racial stereotyping and treating race as a negative. And I do think I've even cited SFFA in the hostile work environment case where you've got employers who are making sweeping negative generalizations about Caucasians. And so I do think that there will potentially be, as Nick, you're alluding to, maybe some broad statements about colorblindness in the narrow majority opinion, but hopefully at least a good concurrence or two from one of the justices on the right. The next question is from Raj Candelaria, who says, how does Title VII get from a person's sex to their sexual proclivities or sexual identity or sexual habits? And I think this is the Bostock criticism, which is how do we get from the idea that you can't be discriminated based on the fact that you are male or female to the idea that you can be protected based on your homosexuality or heterosexuality?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I don't think you can. I mean, from my perspective, the statute says sex, which we all understood back in 1972 when it was passed, that sex meant your sex, you know, male, female, and that's it. It didn't mean your sexual orientation. It didn't mean your gender identity. It didn't mean any of that. And that's the reason Congress tried to amend Title VII to add sexual orientation and gender identity to it multiple times, and it has failed consistently. Yet, you know, our courts have stepped in to fill the gap for us where the legislature has failed. And so I think it's a great question. How do you get there? Now, the analysis the court's given us, which, again, I perceive as wrong, is effectively that you can't discriminate against someone based on their sexual orientation without knowing their sex. So how do you know? I guess the analysis is, how do you know a person's a lesbian if you don't know they're a woman? I mean, just, you know, some of our justices couldn't answer what a woman was, so I'm not sure how they answer that question in the first instance. But let's assume there's a woman who prefers sexual intimacy with another woman, and now, you know, that has to do with sex. And if that's the reason you terminated them, then that's related to sex, and sex is in the statute. And then they took it one step farther with gender identity. So in Bostock, and kind of a, I think, a 2 cubed by half rationalization. And so, yeah, I think it's a good question. How do we get there? And I think it would have been really interesting if the Ohio Solicitor General had come in and said, look, you know, this background circumstance stuff is all fair and well. Even if the court overturns it, great. But this is the only claim remaining for the court's consideration is sexual orientation, and that's not protected by Title VII. Bostock's wrong. You should take this opportunity to correct it and dismiss this claim because it's not protected under Title VII. I think that would have had a really heated and interesting oral argument rather than the more tepid kind of kumbaya we got today. So.
Yeah, that would have been a gutsy move for sure, to come in that way, guns blazing. I mean, the thing about Bostock is that I've always thought they overread the work that but-for sex is doing. You know, an office romance that only occurs because of sex. And if you flip the sex, the office romance wouldn't occur. It doesn't mean that the employer can't fire you for having an office romance, right? I mean, the idea is that sex is designed to mean they fired you because you are male or female, not because of the, you know, secondary or tertiary implications of your sex. All that said, even if you did read Bostock for all it's worth, it wouldn't apply to every sexual orientation. It would only apply to homosexuality. But it wouldn't apply to bisexuality or asexuality or any other form. You know, there are something like 62 different sexual orientations. The only one it works for is homosexuality, because when you flip the sex, that's what happens. So interesting that the Biden administration has read it for all it's worth on the idea of sexual orientation writ large being protected after Bostock. Next question is from Cody Bivens, which is just a brass tack. So do you think it'll be an 8-1 or 9-0 to remove the background circumstances test?
Yeah, I would go 9-0. I didn't get any indication that any of the justices were really big on keeping the background circumstances test. So,
yeah, even if you thought that maybe there were a liberal justice who was going to be, you know, interested in this idea in the abstract of maybe a heightened pleading standard, this didn't seem to be the hill to die on when the parties themselves in front of you were saying, we agree. So even Justice Sotomayor, I don't think he'll be a dissenter. So I read it the same way that you do, as a 9-0. All right. A reminder to keep dropping those questions in the box. We're 3 down. We've got several more to go. Next person, Sarah Reese, says she's practiced employment law for decades and has encountered companies where the commitment to diversity is so strong that a Caucasian person couldn't be hired for a job unless there were really no non-white candidate who was available. More of a comment than a question, back to DEI on this issue of where employers are treating employees differently based on race for the purpose of promotion. Do you think we'll get anything from this case or other cases that are coming down the pike on that issue?
Yeah, it'd be great if we could get some clarity on this issue. I mean, we have several cases against, you know, major Fortune 100 companies where some of them have explicit policies. You know, like one thing that got really popular for, I think because of the some of the different liberal movements, but you know, they had 30% women by 2030, right? And so and then they started offering incentives for managers that if you hit your female hiring target, you'd get a bonus. And then they did it for minorities. We're going to have, you know, 25% minority representation in this category of employment by this date. And like, these aren't secrets. Like, they posted in their 10K, right? It's in the public SEC filings where they set hiring quotas and targets, and then they incentivize managers and their executives to go hit those targets with cash compensation. I mean, to me, that sounds an awful lot like paying for discrimination. You know, there's more subversive things that are going on for people who are paying attention. They have whole AI algorithms now that will weed out candidates before they even get to the interview process based on race and sex. And they'll do it without knowing their race and sex based on the different markers that are in a resume or the different things that are present. So they have whole systems to discriminate against people as they're becoming candidates now to kind of cut off the, oh, well, we didn't discriminate. These were just the candidates that were provided to us. And it's like, well, you can't third party your discrimination. But it is happening. You know, I agree with Sarah. It's definitely happening.
Yeah. Another reason I'm hoping for some really broad concurrences to talk about, you know, maybe how SFFA already gets at this problem, and under SFFA, the affirmative action decision, that we ought not be seeing employers do something like treating race, racial buckets or different people based on race differently. Interesting question. I'm going to skip ahead to John Scheller's question. Will this implicate other parts of Title VII, or other civil rights statutes like age discrimination or disabilities? I guess we could also add religion under Title VII itself, in terms of whether the outcome here will affect those. The answer certainly would be yes, that basically in every situation, even if you're a Christian alleging religious discrimination, you would get no worse of a pleading standard or a summary judgment standard than anyone else, even if you're technically in a majority status. Do you read it the same way?
I do. And I'm not sure of any state civil rights laws, at least I'm not aware of them, that have this kind of built-in background circumstances discrimination, not to say that they don't exist. But I'm not aware of any that kind of have that discriminatory bias built into the majority minority. I think if they do, there's a pretty solid argument that violates equal protection in some way, if you're giving preferences based on race to particular litigants. So
yeah, I agree. Yeah, one of Mr. Wang's very good lines in rebuttal was that his client's asking only for the same thing that's guaranteed on the outside of the courtroom, which is equality under the law, and nothing more. I thought that was rhetorically very strong. Another question from John Scheller. One of the factors, the first factor under the McDonnell-Douglas test, is whether you're a part of a protected class. That definitely has struck me as a little bit meaningless in the race context, because everyone has a race, I suppose, if you think of race as your skin color, or just, you know, the rough bucket that's the socially constructed buckets put you into. So is there any more content to that factor? And maybe the answer is no. In a race case, it doesn't really matter. In a sex case, it doesn't really matter. In a religion.
I think it does matter, because that's the category by which you have to show there's discrimination into. So you can't say like, oh, I'm white and they discriminated against me based on this other belief that has nothing to do with me being white, right? They have to, there's a causative connection between the protected class that you're articulating and then the other elements that you have to go through. So yes, while I agree that generally everybody's going to fall into the protected category, it's really at least the way I think about it, the framework by which you analyze what steps go down and how that connects back to that protected category. So if you're making a race claim, you need to show facts that you were discriminated against based on your race, not against the fact that you were a jerk at work and nobody liked you, right? So
yeah, it's an anchor, really, that the rest of your allegations.
Right, I think that's right.
Yeah, very good. Okay. We've got a reporter question. Kaylin Deese with the Washington Examiner Piggybacking off of the question of whether this will impact Trump's DEI orders, what are the implications for a favorable ruling for Ames as it pertains to corporate DEI efforts? And we've talked a little about the executive orders and the elimination of DEI at the federal government, whether those will hold up. And then we had the comment from Sarah about how employers often are looking to promote within, not non-whites. The corporate training, I suppose, would also be another place where if the court makes a broad colorblindness comment, that'll interact with that. Yeah.
I agree. And I think the Ohio advocate made a good statement that I wrote down. He said, let reverse discrimination fall out of the federal reporter. And I couldn't be in more agreement. It's not a reverse discrimination case. It's just a straight up discrimination case. And if an employer is going to discriminate against someone because they're white, that's just discrimination. It's not different. It's not. And that's part of the problem we've had, I think, is categorically we've thought about it differently. Oh, discriminating against a white person is different than discriminating against a black person. But we ought not think about it that way. And so language like reverse discrimination should be struck from our mouths. We shouldn't use it as advocates. It's just discrimination. We want equality across the board. We want equal treatment for everybody. And that means that discriminating against someone because they're male, female, white, black, Asian, that's just discrimination, period. And so I do think that a favorable ruling here will impact corporate boardrooms in some way. It's just another check mark that should give them pause and say, you know, maybe we should be rethinking our risk profile for some of the policies that we've put into place and start rethinking how we're going to do this.
Yeah. Yeah. I was struck by that line that you just flagged from the advocate for Ohio when he said, let the phrase reverse discrimination fall out of the federal reporter. That indicated to me that he wished that he was on the other side of the case because he didn't want to defend the fact that background circumstances ought to be a thing. But it was a great line to his credit. You know, I was a little bit surprised that having said that, they didn't confess error or something else that would have avoided getting to where we are today. But yeah, that was absolutely a great line. Next question has to do with what the impact on a potential decision would be on universities. So we've talked a lot about companies and corporations. Understandably, this is about Title VII and an employment case. Do you see any implications for educational institutions?
Yeah, huge ones. I think given some of the Dear Colleague letter we got from the Department of Education, I think universities ought to be extraordinarily concerned about what the federal government might do if they continue down the road they've been on in their hiring. You know, I think a lot of professors have commented, maybe not publicly, but anonymously, about hiring at their universities being heavily influenced by race, heavily influenced by factors other than merit or competency or capability. And, you know, the Department of Education, if they decide to strictly start enforcing this against universities, the penalties are much harsher than like a one-off case where you get some back pay, maybe some front pay for an employee. You're talking about losing federal funding. You're talking about potentially having, you know, lots of money go back to the federal government that you obtained through false claims where you said, look, we comply with all the non-discrimination laws that are within the federal government. And we signed the paper that says we comply with them all. And it turns out you've been hiring based on race or based on sex or based on another protected characteristic. I mean, the federal government can come back and demand all of that back and bring litigation on it. And I think if I was a president of a university system, I would be extraordinarily concerned right now that would be what's coming down the pike. And they should really be considering what they're doing, how they're doing it, and maybe start making some pretty rapid changes. And I think this case will only reinforce that for them.
Yeah, totally agree. Our brief, the Mountain States amicus brief, was actually written on behalf of one of our clients, Josh Young, who's a prison guard or was a prison guard in Colorado Springs, who was forced to undergo this really aggressive, you know, quote unquote DEI training, telling him that he's a white supremacist, all whites perpetuate white supremacy, that he thinks of African-Americans as the N-word, and they use the full N-word like in the training, which just imagine like taking your workplace training and the N-word is blaring from your computer, and that's officially sponsored by the state of Colorado. And, you know, we wanted to highlight how this is not just about the obvious situations that you're definitely highlighting very well, like hiring, firing, promotion, but also in these day-to-day training modules where employees are taught that as part of diversity or equity, they need to internalize negative beliefs about themselves in order to be a successful employee. I think all of those are on the chopping block, certainly, both after SFFA and hopefully with a broad opinion here in Ames.
Yeah, I agree. We have a case out in Colorado with a public school official who took one of those trainings and made the innocuous comment that, you know, he's an American, believes in equality for everybody. You know, he thinks America is really great and he loves his country. And, you know, that ended up getting him effectively terminated because of one of those kind of DEI trainings where he didn't go along to get along. And he was like, no, I don't think that I'm a white supremacist because I'm white. Like, no, that's crazy. And there are real consequences to regular people in their everyday lives because of these things. And I hope that, you know, Trump's DEI EO, I hope that cases like Ames and SFFA can be brought to bear against these people who really are anti-American, and if not in their own mind, in their actions outside. So,
yeah. Well, I think we'll leave it there. Terrific. Thank you so much, Nick, for the analysis on the oral argument and the implications across the board at corporations and universities and all around. What an interesting talk. And thank you to all the folks who submitted questions. It was a nice, healthy audience today. And we're looking forward to seeing you again at the next courthouse steps. With that, Marco, I'm going to go ahead and turn it back over to you.
Well, thank you both for that fantastic discussion and the benefit of your time and expertise today. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I would also like to thank you, our audience, for joining us. We greatly appreciate your participation. For more information on upcoming events, please visit our website or all major social media platforms at FedSoc. On that note, we are adjourned. Thank you again.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.